Dean said that I was in the chemistry division at Argonne National Lab for 20 years, actually, and last year I moved over to our new nanotechnology center. This is at Argonne National Lab. This is a Department of Energy laboratory 25 miles southwest of Chicago. And this is an, let's see if this works, this is an aerial picture of the lab. I think it's 3,000 or 4,000 acres in the middle of a forest preserve. This is an aerial view from the west. And so you get a nice view here of the advanced photon source, the synchrotron ring at Argonne. And the Center for Nanoscale Materials, or the CNM, is attached to the APS. It's this bright white building here. I guess the bright white indicates that it's brand new. And there are a few other of these triangular-shaped buildings that also look bright white. These are also newer. The APS itself is about 10 years old now, and the CNM just opened as a building a year and a half ago. And so, okay, for the talk, the diversity of synthetic nanoparticles, really the world could be my oyster talking about such a thing. And I decided in the end that I had to talk about what I was most familiar with and most comfortable with. And so I have two parts to this talk. One is to discuss the CNM in general, give you a little bit of an overview of what's going on at our nanotechnology center, give some examples of nanoscale materials being made there, and then some highlights from my research on synthetic nanoparticles that are related to clays. I'm a clay scientist. I've done quite a bit of work with synthetic hectorites and synthetic polymer clay nanocomposites. So the nano gets in there and is relevant to the symposium. And then I'll work that in with some recent research results with a collaborator of mine, Dr. Darren Martin in Australia, and a project that we just started last year on the toxicology of nanoparticles. And so this is recent work. It's not published yet. I thought it'd be nice to bring it, give it some exposure here at this meeting. So the CNM, it's a Department of Energy user facility for nanoscience research. This is a very new thing. Some of you might be familiar with synchrotrons run by the Department of Energy. There's the ALS, Advanced Light Source, the Advanced Photon Source, a few others. There's one at Brookhaven. So DOE decided to start a new thing, have a similar concept, but for nanoscience and nanotechnology. There are five of these centers across the country. They're all associated with different national labs. Ours is with Argonne. And while they all have overlapping expertise, they also all have something unique to them. So DOE likes to spread their facilities across the country so that people have some choice geographically. But also there is some expertise, and ours is that we are connected to the APS for a reason, and that is because we share a beamline with them. Sector 26, we have a hard X-ray nanoprobe. So that's really what makes us unique in this of the five nano centers. So our center is explicitly tailored to the creation and characterization of new functional materials on the nanoscale, and ostensibly they support the DOE Basic Energy Sciences mission in fundamental research in energy. Our website is here, and if you'd like to have a specific question you want to address to somebody, if you can't catch me here today, here's an email address. I'd love to hear from all of you. I also have some fact sheets with me. I've got a folder I can hand out, and our fact sheets are also available at this website. And there is detailed information on the people who are in the division. There are about 40, 45 scientists there now, and the tools and instrumentation that we have. So just one slide here. I wanted to give you just one example of what it means to be at the nanoscale and properties that affects. And this is a nice slide because it's so highly visual, just looking at color. So materials properties are unique at the nanoscale, and here we show an example of color. At the macro scale, so micron and bigger, color is based on using or controlled by using different pigments. And so we show here an example of different latex paints where you put in different heavy metal oxides to control the color. And there's some examples up here, oxides, carbon black, for example, to affect the color. At the nanoscale, however, color can actually be an effect based on size. And this isn't just a light scattering effect. These samples shown here, these are cuvettes in solution of binary particles of zinc sulfide capped with cadmium selenide. And the size of those, when they shine with light, has an effect on the color. And it's the surface to volume ratio at the small scale. Usually at the nanoscale, you're talking up to about 200 nanometers. These are quite a bit smaller than that. But you just change the size a little bit, and you change the surface to volume ratio of the coating over the core, and that affects the band gap, the energy gap, and the fluorescence can span the rainbow. So this is just one example of a property that can be affected at the nanoscale. And what I decided to do next was pick three recent examples of materials that have been made, publications that have come out of the CNM, just to give you an idea. The title of my talk is The Diversity of Synthetic Nanoparticles. So at the CNM, one project that has just been published, this pointer here, is coming out this month in the journal Small, and it's work from Yugang Sun. Why Sun up here? Yugang, he's one of our synthetic gurus, really talented in the laboratory. And this is showing the growth of silver nanoplatelets, so this is a metal, on a semiconductor wafer. So this is gallium arsenide semiconductor wafer, and it says here via galvanic reaction. That's a fancy way of saying he dripped silver nitrate onto his semiconductor, let it stand there a few minutes and washed it off, looked at the surface, and lo and behold, by AFM or TEM, it looked like this. These are 50 to 70 nanometer thick silver metal sheets, and they're actually hemispherical. When I looked at this, for some reason, I thought of the ninja stars. Picture a bunch of them thrown randomly into the wall, and they're sticking out in random orientations, these hemispheres coming out of the gallium arsenide surface. You get an idea of the dimension here if you see the 50 to 70 nanometer thick. And Yugang is quite interested in looking at these surfaces for catalytic applications, in electrodes, sensors, and that kind of thing. He's in the nanophotonics group at the CNM. The group leader is Gary Wiederichs. He's a world expert in near-field scanning optical microscopy and nanophotonics. So he's interested overall in looking at these things for surface-enhanced spectroscopy, the nanophotonics applications, and also the catalysis. Another example, again from Yugang, this is a recent article on palladium nanoparticles, another metal, but this time it's palladium, that are electrodeposited onto carbon nanotubes. This is a very unique thing for hydrogen sensors. Typically, current hydrogen sensors use their rigid materials, and they use pure palladium, so they're quite expensive. So he, with Hao Wang at Argonne, they decided to do a whole different ball game. So they used a two-step process of CVD and dry transfer printing to load carbon nanotubes onto a plastic film. After they had that, they electrodeposited palladium onto the carbon. It selectively went onto the carbon, see from this AFM, and imaged it. Looks like a lot of palladium here, but that's from contrast effects. And it's actually much lower weight percent palladium on the system. And so this is now on a flexible sheet of plastic film. And so you can have a lot more applications for this type of material in manufacture. See, it's blown up here. It's connected to two gold electrodes. So they can measure the current change upon detecting hydrogen when hydrogen gets incorporated. And you can see they've been used to detect 1% hydrogen in 3 seconds, this material. And one last example is from one of our other groups. This is Seth Darling's work. He combines two different approaches to self-assembly of nanomaterials. Maybe you've heard of the terms of top-down and bottom-up when creating nanoscale assemblies. Those are two different approaches for making a long range or an order from, say, a nanoparticle. So a chemist would do bottom-up. We start with atoms or small molecules and make something different, perhaps something bigger. But the idea in nanotechnology is to order that in a regular way. You want to make an array so that you can transfer energy or a bias or some kind of signal from one end to another. And so that's called the bottom-up approach. Top-down is lithography or patterning. Think of Intel and the chip makers. They use electron beams or focused ion beams and other methods to draw onto a chip at the nanometer scale, features and lines. So what Seth is doing, he's combining both of those approaches for his system. Seth is a chemist, and so he's interested in iron-platinum binary magnetic nanoparticles. You see here, he can make them very narrow distribution of particles, 3 to 5 nanometers, so they're about 4 nanometers in size. They're capped with a surfactant, with an organic, It's actually attracted to certain polymeric materials over others. So the idea here is to use a dye-block copolymer template for arranging the iron platinum nanoparticles. So the iron platinum is attracted to one polymer in the dye block and not the other. This is, happens to be a polystyrene PMMA. And what he does, I lost my pointer. So he lays down his dye block copolymer onto a surface, and you get sort of this fingerprint structure you see in the background here, and then uses vacuum UV to selectively etch away one of the blocks. I forget which one it is. Might be the polystyrene. That gets etched away. Then you're left with a surface of hills and valleys. And the iron platinum is actually attracted to the polymer that's left and gets selectively attracted to that from a solution and deposits into the valleys of this hill and valley structure. So this is a TEM image, an AFM image, AFM images of a, I forget exactly what, but a fairly low dispersion of iron platinum loading in this system. He can completely fill these valleys with iron platinum by increasing the loading. And this on the right shows the journal cover for the article when it was published, and that's of course just a cartoon image of the kind of system he has in mind, where he's using sort of this top-down approach, the not exactly lithography, but employing VUV, the vacuum UV etching, to make these valleys, and then depositing particles into them. So the last slide here on the CNM, just to show you, we have six integrated research themes that managerially the CNM is organized around. In reality, everybody works with everybody. The equipment is all shared. It's used by the staff. It's used by users. We have the user program. So we have nanobio interfaces. And a nice image here shows that our group leader, Tiana Reich, has expertise in combining ceramic or semiconductor particles, for example, titania, TiO2, and covalently binding them to DNA and other biological molecules. And she's interested in energy transduction applications for that, but some users are interested in medical and therapeutic applications, where you can shine light or give energy to the semiconductor that travels down the biological molecule. And they've done things like DNA scission. The nanofabrication group is the clean room facility. We have 12,000 square feet of clean room filled with electron beam and other lithography equipment. And their goal is to discover new paths for nanostructured materials, including patterning down to and below 10 nanometers. And this is a recent image from Dr. Leo Okola in the group, who's made 13 nanometer metal structures by a technique called cold patterning. Nanophotonics, I've already shown you some examples from them. The X-ray microscopy, this is the X-ray nanoprobe that's at the advanced photon source. It's the highest resolution X-ray microscope in the world. They routinely can image features to 20 nanometers at the beamline. They have gotten images down to 10 nanometers. And by employing some techniques out into the future, they project getting down to 2 nanometers. And the sample hutch here is equipped with a fluorescence detector, a diffractometer, and transmission. So you can get that kind of information all on one sample. The theory and modeling group is just installing a Beowulf class cluster that I'm told has a compute capacity of 10 teraflops. And that's used to support everybody's efforts at the CNM. And finally, one of our largest groups, electronic and magnetic materials, a lot of synthetic people here. People with expertise in measuring, characterizing electronic properties and magnetic properties, and also creating devices out of those. This picture is a single magnetic spin, or a single magnetic vortex flipping. That's from Christian Buchanan in the EMMD group. So now I'm going to switch gears and talk about some synthetic work that I'm familiar with. As it relates to clay research. I thought that'd be of extreme interest to most of the people here in the room, and relates a little bit to some talks coming up later in the day. So I have some background in making synthetic hectorites and these nanocomposites, and I'll go through this part of the talk now. So for synthetic hectorites, we're talking about the layered magnesium silicates, the smectite structure. For making these, simply combine a 2-8% slurry in water of silica, magnesium hydroxide, lithium fluoride, boil it for 2 days, the pH is 10, and the clay falls out. The platelet sizes generally range from 20 to 200 nanometers, so again, it's on this nanoscale. And organic templates can be optionally doped in. They can be cationic or neutral, and that's what the red blocks are showing over here. We've looked at a whole variety of different organics. We've studied the mechanism of formation of this in detail with a variety of techniques. And some of these references are shown here. If you're interested, you can look there for more information. When the organic is a water-soluble polymer, so now we're crystallizing the clay in the presence of a polymer, we can make a new class of polymer clay nanocomposites, these PCNs. And so I wanted to talk about polymer clay nanocomposites just for a couple of slides, show you what they are and why people are interested in them. So here are three structural regimes, two end regimes and then an intermediate structure for PCNs. The nano comes from the fact that the clay platelet itself in the C dimension is 1 nanometer thick. So when you have the house of cards structure of a clay dispersed into a polymeric matrix, you have a completely exfoliated structure. A and B are large, but in the C dimension, that platelet is 1 nanometer. And the interface between the polymer and the platelet can have quite a dramatic effect. At the other end of the regime, you have intercalated, where the clay layers retain their registry. You have 1, 2, maybe 3 polymeric chains between the layers. And it's oriented this way because this particular TEM image shows the striations of the clay layers in that arrangement. So here you retain registry, and you have a despacing. It looks like a regular clay intercalate. At the other end of the extreme, you have the exfoliated system. There is no despacing here. And then everything in between, a mixed intercalated exfoliated system, the TEM image here on the bottom right. So why are people interested in these? They're commercially relevant in three main areas, and then they also are being looked at by some research groups for specialty applications. But you'll find a lot of patent literature in these three areas. For mechanical applications, this field was founded by Toyota in the late 80s to look at lightweight structural reinforcement for automotive applications. So components for automobiles to make them still strong but lighter weight and increase the energy efficiency. Flammability and ablative properties are of interest at NIST and the Air Force. And most of the time the polymers they're looking at are polypropylene and polystyrene for these. And finally, there's a lot of patent literature out for the gas barrier application. So this is transparent films for food packaging and also liners for tires and things like that. In fact, they are used in a high-performance tennis ball. See, by Wilson over here, there's an exfoliated vermiculite in there with the polymer. I don't know which one. And that allows the tennis ball to retain its bounce for a longer period of time. And so my background in that research led Dr. Darren Martin at Australia to get in touch with me for some projects he was interested in. He's been at the University of Queensland for quite some time and began to get involved with the Australian Institute for Bioengineering and Nanotechnology. He has a joint appointment between them. And we started to discuss projects we could work on together while the building was being built. It just opened a year ago, so their website is here if you're interested. And so we wrote a grant together. Put together a team for a challenge project. It's called the Toxicology of Nanoparticles Towards a More Effective Approach. It started in August 2006, still going on. Darren came out this summer to meet with me, and we went over some preliminary results. You know, research can be somewhat slow when you're beginning. So here I'm going to show you some slides, some highlights of what's been found in the past year. At first, I just wanted to show the team and point out that really, when you're talking about something like this, you need a vast array of expertise to help you get at what you need. So we have a materials scientist, a molecular pharmacologist, a radiochemist, because the assay of choice uses radio labeling, inorganic chemist, and organometallic chemist. The project is based on using three types of nanoparticles: carbon nanotubes, layered double hydroxides — many of you probably know they're the anionic version of the cationic clays — and synthetic hectorites. So all three of these are actually synthetic. They were chosen because they're commercially relevant. Dilute, stable aqueous suspensions can be made to allow nanoscale delivery and exposure in a biological system. The radio tracer probes that are used for this project can be incorporated during their synthesis. And really, these three were chosen to study the charge effects and the size effects on nanotoxicology. So in terms of charge, we're going from neutral to anionic to cationic, and going from fiber or one-dimensional to platelet or two-dimensional materials, and comparing those. Developing assays and probing in vitro stability. So I'll show you some just preliminary results in these three main areas. The isotope of choice for radio labeling is cobalt-57 because of its long half-life. It has a similar ionic radius to magnesium. Magnesium is inside the LDH and the hectorite structures, so it can be incorporated during synthesis. And they started their project this way for synthesis with the LDHs first, and did some preliminary work on hectorite in terms of the fluorescent dyes. I'm not aware of the work yet bringing cobalt into the hectorite structure. And they started the biological studies with the hectorite systems. So in terms of incorporating the cobalt-57 into LDH, the TEM image just shows that the size and shape of the platelets don't change on incorporating a little bit of a radio label. 0.1 weight percent cobalt here has no effect, which is good. The plot on the right shows that you can change the particle size distribution just by stopping the synthesis at various points along the way. So this is 0.5 weight percent cobalt in an LDH synthesis, 2 hours, 4 hours, 10 hours of hydrothermal treatment, and you can see that the average particle size is increasing with time. Then they were interested in LDH structural breakdown as a function of pH, since we're interested in vitro stability. These are solid bases, so you expect them to be stable at higher pHs, and they are. Down here from pH 9, all through the pHs of relevance to biological systems, they are stable. This is showing the percentage of cobalt that's present in the structure and its release in solution. At pH 5, there's a little bit of release of the cobalt, so there's a little bit of degradation of the structure. And at pH 4, really, you've dissolved the whole thing in this acidic pH within 4 to 8 hours. But through the biological regime, they are stable. This is an example of a result from using the hectorites. They started using three synthetic hectorites that are available commercially. So they started with lapinite, RD and RDS, and also lucentite, which I think is available from Japan, and incorporated a fluorescent dimeric cyanine dye called yo-yo into the hectorite. And this is to use it as a probe into biological systems. So this image here is optical microscopy image of THP1 cells. These are human leukemia cells, before and after treatment with a yo-yo labeled lapinite RDS clay. And so this shows on the right that the cells are internalizing this dye-labeled hectorite, but the cell itself is stable. It's not lysing, it's not dying when the clay gets incorporated. So one might imagine sometime in the future you could attach something for therapeutic purposes as well. And then finally, one example of a result, the interest in polymer clay nanocomposites. The Darren Martin's group has a lot of background in polyurethane PCNs. They use them in surgical gloves and various medical applications for plastics. And now they're interested in making implantable biomedical devices out of them. And so in vitro stability is critical, and there is no information about that yet. So we've just started a little bit of work on that, looking at these in biological conditions. So what they started with was a polyurethane PCN film and looked at release of the hectorite from the film after it's been soaking in a solution for a period of days. And what we see here are four different films that were made, see 30 up to 650 nanometers. That's the size of the clay platelet in the nanocomposite. And there, going from 30 to 650, there isn't any real trend. You see that they all release clay into solution after one day and on out to 7 days. This 0% strain means it's just they make the film, put it in the solution. Well, they decided to test what effect fatigue had on the film. So what they did was pre-stretch them to see if that would break down the film and increase the rate of release of the clay from the sample. And what they found, in fact, is that it happened in most of the cases. But most interesting, it did not happen in one of the cases, this here, the red curve. And in fact, it got better with strain. The rate of release of the clay from the film in solution is even less after strain than before. And so they focused on the 75 nanometer sample, imaged it, and by TEM and other tests, they see that this has the best dispersion. This is the completely exfoliated sample. So that they'll be focusing on this one in the future. And so finally, I just want to say that there's a wealth of materials out there, both natural and synthetic. Dean is putting together a very nice, Dean and his co-organizer John, putting together a very nice symposium today to capture the diversity of research into synthetic and natural nanoparticles related to soils. I just wanted to show a few examples, you know, outside that realm, some research that's going on. And also point out that I mentioned that there are five of these sister centers from the Department of Energy around the country. They're shown here. Our user programs are similar to the light sources, so if you write a proposal and it gets accepted and you plan to publish your research, all access is free. So all of the equipment and instrumentation is available for free to do that work. But at the same time, they recognized at the launch of these things a responsibility to do things safely. And so each center has an EH&S person in charge, environmental health and safety, and they asked those five people to make a working group and craft a charter to detail responsibilities called Approach to Nanomaterial ES&H. I have a draft of that charter, they're on revision 2, with me if anybody's interested in taking a look at it. And it has been lauded by DOE. They really like the approach that they took to this. And also a recent external assessment of the NNI, this is the National Nanotechnology Initiative, also really appreciated and made an example of this report to all of the agencies that are part of the NNI. So that's it for my presentation.
We have time for questions for Katie.
This one?
What's the range, the size of distribution? It just seems to be kind of wide.
Yes, it's a very wide distribution, especially at the short reaction times. So
basically by stopping the reaction time earlier, are these significantly different from each other, the average size?
The average size increases with time globally, and the particle size distribution narrows with time, but they're similar in other way, in every other way.
As sort of the nanoscience, nanotechnology thing takes off in the government, there are a lot of different people that are defining nanoparticles differently. How is DOE defining nanoparticles? Is it based solely on size, or is the link between size and chemical, physical, magnetic, electronic properties?
Right now it's based pretty much on size, that some aspect of it has to be somewhere within the 1 to 200 nanometer regime.
And even though, a lot of materials above 100 nanometers don't exhibit any type of nano-type properties, they behave solely as the bulk.
Right, yeah.
That's kind of the...
Yeah, this 200 thing, I don't think you'll see it in print anywhere. So when that starts to happen, then it's not of interest anymore. But not every material is like that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the idea of the mechanism of uptake of the nanoparticles into the cell could be shown.
Could you repeat the question?
I think she has a question about this slide, is that right? You wanted to know the mechanism of uptake? I am completely ignorant about that topic. I'm sorry. That's a good question. I'm not qualified to answer it, unfortunately.
More questions? Okay, then we'll move on. Thank you, Katie.